your science magazine of the air. Once again, your science magazine of the air presents a stirring dramatization of one of the great discoveries of science.
A murder is committed, but there are no clues. Yet the police move in, secure evidence, applying incredible scientific methods to track down a killer. Science, exploring the unknown. Science at work, pushing forward the boundary between today and tomorrow, searching for knowledge that will shape your world of the future. Dramatic stories of science and industry. The police move in, searching for evidence. Yes, that is our story for today, starring the popular actor of stage and screen, Walter Abel. The story of scientific crime detection. Three chapters from the Notebooks of Crime with Walter Abel as Ed Davis. Our first chapter, How Science Fights Crime with Chemistry. The Case of the Silent Murder. Midnight. A dark room. A tiptoe figure moves stealthily. His name is Tails, and he's a thief. Cheap crook prowling for a big haul. Suddenly, a door opens.
Who's there? Who's there?
Tails hides in a shadow by the door. His face is tense, his lips tight.
Who's there?
Funny, I thought I heard something.
Tails' iron fingers clutch the man's throat. Tight, tight, tighter. He closes the door softly, and the room is dark again. Black. Like death. 30 seconds ago, Tails was a thief. Now, he's a murderer.
Fool. I didn't even make a noise before he opened the door. I had to scram. Now, he had to sneak up on me, catch me. Then I had to get him. Let's see. Did I leave anything? Okay, nothing. Nothing. Them flat feet can't find a knife or a slug. I'm too smart. I use my mitts. Don't leave no traces. Choke the guy. No bullet, no trace, no evidence.
Nothing, Tails? Nothing? Are you sure there isn't a clue, a crumb, a thread of evidence? Don't be too sure, Tails. Because there's a guy whose job it is to find evidence where it doesn't seem to be. A guy named Eddie Davis.
Crime Detection Laboratory. Davis speaking.
Ed, this is Barker.
Yes, Lieutenant?
Up on Commonwealth 1756.
1756, Commonwealth.
The name is McLean. Homicide and robbery.
Check. Job and I will go right up. Operator, ring the photographic division. And then call Jarvis.
Here we are, John.
Big, quiet place, didn't it?
Yeah, probably read in the paper they were giving a dinner tonight. And he got in while the cocktails were going strong. Hello, Parker.
Come up in the bedroom, Ed. Guy's head hit the dresser when he fell. Killer got away with plenty of jewelry.
Come on. Jar.
Yeah, Ed?
Have the boys photograph this window screen.
His pocket knife. Simple. Just cut the screen near the retaining hook and he's in.
Right. When they finish photographing that area, wrap the screen up. We'll test it down at the lab.
I'll get Al on it right away.
Wait a minute, John.
Yeah?
Here. On the windowsill.
Yeah? Looks clean to me. Like the maid wiped it this morning.
She probably did. But the minute you wipe something, another film of dust settles on it. So fine, you can't see it, but enough to take a print.
You're right. There is a print on the sill. But darn faint. It isn't a handprint.
No, but it's some kind. Have Al photograph it. Then scrape up a sample of the dust.
Hey, I'll bring your camera over here.
Methodically, Davis and Jarvis searched the room for fingerprints.
Apparently wiped everything off as he went along, Ed.
Bound to have left something someplace. Nobody can rob, kill, and leave no trace. Nobody.
Inch by inch they search, examining every drawer, every surface.
Al. Bring your camera here.
Coming, Ed.
Take four-way shots of this corner of the desk. And that little piece of thread caught on the edge.
See that little hunk of gray thread? It'll hardly show up.
It may show up plenty of things in the lab.
Shoot, Al.
Here's that windowsill print, Ed. I made an enlargement.
Thanks, Al. Still doesn't show up very clear. Let's put it under the magnifying slide.
Here.
Good. It's a knee print where the fellow knelt on the sill. Someone probably wearing herringbone trousers.
How do you get that, Ed?
Those little lines of dots showing up in the dust look like a herringbone pattern. And perhaps that thread we took from the desk will help us.
Back at the laboratory, with a strand of gray thread under his microscope, Davis finds
hooks on the fiber, so it's wool. Thin split ends, so it's cheap. Mixed with short, smooth cellulose fibers, that makes a gram. Print marks in the thread for weaving in an up-and-down pattern. Lighter shade cream on exposed spots. Crisscrossing in the diagonal every millimeter. Herringbone was right. All right. So, the fellow was wearing gray herringbone trousers of cheap mixed wool and rayon. Now, I'll have the chem lab analyze this for the dye stuff and any other stains and examine specimens of McLean's hair and the hair that Jarve scraped out from under McLean's fingernail.
Davis adjusts a double-slide comparison microscope. On one slide, he puts specimens of McLean's hair. On the other, the hairs from under the murdered man's fingernail. Studying it, Davis sees
very smooth scales, so it's human hair. That rules out McLean's dog, so McLean couldn't have picked it up petting his pup.
Oh, Ed.
Hello, Jarve. Looks like you got something when you scraped out that hair.
Then it isn't from McLean's head?
No. Possibly from the killer's. A short hair with a cut edge. McLean must have grabbed this fellow's shoulder and his nail snagged the fallen hair.
A white man?
Yeah. A microscopic cross-section shows the rounded circumference of hair from a white person. Here, look in the mic.
Yeah. Yep, the fiber of slightly wavy hair.
Curl index about 95. The specimens from McLean's on the right-hand slide.
Uh-huh, straight.
And you see there that McLean's hair has about 30 to 40% pigmentation, light brown. No trace of hair dye. The other has about 60% pigmentation with dye granules, dark brown.
Oh, the way crooks fall for a dye job. They got the idea that dyed hair disguises them.
They can't beat the microscope.
All right, Ed. I brought you in a guy that shows the show-up that answers your specifications.
Thanks, Sergeant.
Gray herringbone pants. Cheap.
Now, listen.
Coarse brown hair. Carrying a hefty jackknife.
What do you expect I got to wear these days? A full-dress suit? When you can't even buy no shirts? I tell you, I never been near the place.
He's got a record, Ed. They call him Tails. He's out on parole now.
Yeah, I'm too smart to pull a job and stick my neck out again.
You see, take off your pants.
Now, wait a minute.
Take off. Jarve.
Yeah?
Have the chem lab take a thread from every snag in those pants and compare it with the fiber I found on the desk. And Jarve, compare a print from the knee with the print on the windowsill.
Right.
And tell the chem lab to run the hand vacuum over the knees of the trousers and compare the dust sample with the sample from the windowsill.
Ah, you'll find no dust on my clothes. I keep them fresh.
Admirable, admirable, but futile.
Huh?
Not even dry cleaning removes all the dust embedded in the fabric. And dust from every locality, from every street, has its own chemical characteristics.
Here's a knife, Ed.
Good.
Say, I want that back. That's a good knife. Not a nick on it.
Maybe there's something else on it. Jarve, while I pull a few hairs from this gentleman's head...
Hey, what the...
And compare them with the one from McLean's nail, have the chem lab test the knife for any foreign material on the blade.
In the chemical laboratory, investigators find a tiny speck no larger than the head of a pin at the base of the knife. Removing it with a steel needle, they turn to the spectrograph, the amazing device which detects each different element by the characteristic lines it makes in the spectrum.
Well, Ed, the spectrograph shows that the fragment has iron, zinc, cadmium, and copper present as traces in the same amount as in the window screen. Same length of lines in the spectrum.
Tell Ed that the dust sample from the trousers is identical with the dust sample from the windowsill. X-ray diffraction and microanalytical runs show the same crystal formation. Crystals of carbon, nitric garden fertilizer, talcum powder, skin flakes from a person with eczema, pollen from forsythia.
I tell, there you have it. It all adds up to you. Scientific proof from your knife, your knee print, your own hair, the clothes you wear, and even the dust in them.
You win. All right, copper, I'll confess.
And now, the second chapter of Scientific Crime Detection, Ballistics, the case of the telltale gun. A gun. The crook's best friend, he thinks. The crook's worst enemy, the crime laboratory knows. Every gun has its own story to tell the investigator trained in firearms identification and in ballistics. Even a spent bullet buried in a wall and an empty cartridge shell provide incriminating evidence.
Here it is, Ed. Way over here. Yeah? Copper jacket at 38, Western Cartridge Company.
Automatic?
Yeah. Has extractor mark on the rim and a mark on the head where the automatic ejector grabs it and flips it out of the gun.
Have Al measure the distance of the shell from Garrison.
Looks about 14 feet from here.
That would probably place the gunman about 8 feet from Garrison when he shot him, since automatics usually throw their shells to the right and about 6 feet to the rear.
Well, that squares up with finding no powder traces on Garrison.
Maybe.
But Harrison had been shot close up at any range up to 20 inches. We'd have found traces of gunpowder on him.
Unless his clothes absorbed the powder.
Okay. You find the bullet yet?
It's embedded over here in the woodwork.
Well, can you get it out all right?
Not without scratching. I'll have to cut it out with a small section of the wood and take it down to the lab, and then I can get to work identifying it.
No two guns in the world make the same marks on a bullet. That's because a gun is rifled. It's barrel drilled and then machined with a rifling cutter that makes spiraling grooves inside the barrel. This rifling is not the same in any two barrels because wear and differences in the metal slightly change the rifling cutter each time it's used. Therefore, each gun cuts its own distinctive marks on every bullet it fires.
Six lands, narrow, six grooves fairly wide. Spiraling left, moderate twist. Okay, Jarve. That's the rifling of a Colt 38 automatic. Get Parker on the intercom.
Right.
Parker speaking.
Say, Parker, on the Garrison case.
Yeah?
The bullet's from a Colt 38 automatic.
Good. Just got one for you to compare. Just picked up a suspect carrying one. I'll send the gun right up to the lab.
In the firearms identification laboratory, Davis prepares to fire a test bullet from the suspected gun into a steel box packed with cotton waste. Lifting the cover from the box, Davis feels for the bullet buried in the cotton waste. He covers it, carries it to the comparison microscope, where the fatal bullet is already in place on one mount. Davis rotates both bullets simultaneously, end to end, under the microscope, studying the lands and grooves and tiny striations left on the two bullets by the rifling.
Jarve, they match. The rifling striations on the fatal bullet meet end to end with those on the suspect. These two bullets were fired from the same gun. This gun. It killed Garrison.
Oh, what if the bullet was from this gun? You can't pin a murder rap on me. I shot Garrison in self-defense.
Self-defense, Red?
Yeah, he came at me with a gun. I went for him and got it away from him. Then he comes at me again. He wrestled. When he gets me around the neck, I let him have it. With his own gun, the gun you found on me.
So you say it was Garrison's gun. The serial number's been filed off.
I never looked to see. I should have thrown it in the drink.
Jarve, take this gun up to the chem lab. But wait a minute. Red.
Yeah?
You say you shot in self-defense.
I had to. The guy had me around the neck.
I see. That would make you shooting at close quarters.
That was darn near strangling.
But Jarvis found the shell 14 feet away, making you stand at least 8 feet from Garrison when you shot.
How do I know some bull or somebody didn't kick the shell? Where you guys found it after it happened don't mean a thing.
Not in itself. Jarve.
I have the gun, Ed.
While you're up in the chem lab, get the report on the powder residue in Garrison's coat.
In the crime detection laboratory, a chemist works on Garrison's coat. He first immerses glossy photographic paper in a 5% solution of intermediate 2 naphthalamine 4-8 disulfonic acid. Drying the paper, he lines it with towels, puts the coat on them, and presses it with a warm iron. Then, looking on the photographic paper for the telltale reddish-brown stains of particles of powder that are blown only a short distance from the muzzle, less than 2 feet, he finds
no trace of powder residue. Tell Ed the test was negative. Garrison was not shot close up. The bullet was fired from more than 2 feet away.
Meanwhile, another chemist works to bring back the serial number on the fatal gun. To the eye, the metal looks bare. Every trace of the serial number filed away. But when a serial number is stamped on a gun at the factory by a steel die, the pressure of the die stamp leaves tiny cracks or fractures in the metal.
When the crime detection laboratory chemist pours an etching acid on the gun, a chemical reagent shows up the fracture, reproducing the lines of the original serial number.
978965. Got it,
Jarve? Yeah, thanks. We'll start tracing it. From Simon Records first, and then the retail store.
It's no go, Ray. You didn't shoot in self-defense.
But I tell you...
There was no powder in Garrison's coat. You shot from a distance...
Now listen, will
you? And you didn't grab Garrison's gun. The chem lab brought out the serial number on the gun, and it's been traced to you. You bought the gun you used on Garrison.
Yes, firearms identification. Steel-clad eyewitness. But the annals of scientific crime detection record other techniques which further prove that crime does not pay. Now... The third chapter in today's broadcast, The Case of the Talking Fingers. Fingerprints, perhaps the greatest ally of justice. The prints of your 10 fingers, of the palms of your hands, of the soles of your feet. They are your prints, forming loops, arches, and whorls in a pattern that is yours alone. And that pattern begins in the third month of the embryo and remains the same throughout life. And even after death. Experts have taken fingerprints from even an Egyptian mummy. Fingerprints, your safeguard in case of accident or false accusation. For the lawbreaker, undeniable proof of his crime.
Right in here, Mr. Davis.
You told them not to disturb anything.
The maid was starting to clean up, but I stopped her. The bellboy, too.
I'm afraid they still had time to smear off fingerprints. Probably leave some of their own.
But I called them right away,
you
sir.
Couldn't help it. Hotel managers are pretty busy people.
You just fingerprint them and then compare their prints with whatever we find.
Methodically, Jarvis and Ed Davis searched the hotel room for fingerprints. Because no one can touch anything without leaving a fingerprint.
Nothing on the door handle, Ed. Dusting with aluminum powder doesn't bring out a thing.
To bring out fingerprints on dark surfaces, investigators dust them with powdered aluminum. On light surfaces, a mixture of lamp black and carbon.
Nothing on this white dressing table.
Try the door frame. When a fellow tries to close the door quietly, he nearly always puts his hand on the frame.
Well, he picked a good door, then. Full of polish.
Surfaces polished with oil or wax do not reveal fingerprints with dusting powder.
You have an iodine blow tube, haven't you, John?
Well,
gather up your aging strength and blow into it.
To find fingerprints on greasy surfaces, an iodine blow tube, a 6-inch glass tube fitted with 2 glass feeding tubes, anhydrous calcium chloride, iodine crystals, glass wool, and a man's breath.
Ed, it's showing up, a print on the wood. The iodine fumes are working all right.
Have Al get a picture of it.
Yep. Hey, you have any luck?
I'm going to try this package of face tissue. Chances are the killer took some to wipe off his other fingerprints and left prints on this paper box.
Here are the blow-ups, Ed.
Thanks, Al. Now, let's see. The arch loop, whorl, or loop?
Davis concentrates intently. Fingerprints fall into one of 3 general groups. The arch group, the whorl group, or the loop.
The delta.
The core. The delta. The fixed point where the innermost ridge lines of the pattern area begin to diverge. At that focal point, Davis begins counting the ridges. The core. The focal center of the pattern. Between the delta and the core, Davis expertly counts the ridges and notes their formation. Then, his trained eye establishes definite characteristics.
Here you are, John. T29, L over L, 1 over 1, U over U, 6 over 10.
T29, 29 ridges between the core and the delta on the right thumb. 7 ridges more than the number accepted as large, so 29 becomes L over L, large over large. And U over U, ulnar loop over ulnar loop. 6 over 10, 6 ridges on the loop structure of the right little finger with 10 for the left. Eddie Davis checks these facts. Confirms the evidence.
All right, John. Follow through on this. Bureau of Identification, FBI. Find out who did it.
What's this note mean?
Whoever it was tried to change his prints by surgery.
Them guys are always suckers for a gimmick.
That's why they're criminals. Only a sucker would take up that profession.
Yes, Eddie Davis was right. The criminal had tried to change his fingerprints.
$1,000, you say?
$1,000. $1,000, Lippy, to change your fingerprints. Too much to save your neck?
My neck, yeah.
Okay, it's a deal.
You're getting off cheap, Lippy. You fingerprints.
You put me asleep.
Complete anesthesia. You won't feel a thing. It'll take only an hour or so to obliterate the characteristic lines on your fingers. Only an hour or so, Lippy.
Lippy had his fingers operated on. Now he thought he'd be safe. But he was apprehended. And so quietly, so casually, that the arrest came at an anticlimax. No thrilling chase, no exciting manhunt. Just Eddie Davis studying the prints, doing his job.
Lippy, you threw your money away.
What do you mean?
You should have asked, among others, John Dillinger.
I don't know him.
Dillinger had his fingerprints operated on, too, Lippy. All you need is courtroom evidence is 12 to 15 points of identity. In reality, fingerprints can provide several hundred identification points. When the FBI had disposed of John Dillinger, they compared his so-called new fingerprints, changed by surgery, with his original prints. Oh, yes, scar tissue had changed some of the natural points. But Lippy, even with the scar tissue, the FBI found on Dillinger's prints more than 300 points of identity. 300 points.
What's that got to do with
only this, Lippy. His doctor did a better job than yours. And we got him. Your fingers talk. Take him away, boy.
And here again is Walter Abel.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've enjoyed this opportunity of appearing on Exploring the Unknown, one of radio's most informative and entertaining programs. Now, I have the pleasure of introducing one of the nation's leading police scientists, Dr. Lemoyne Snyder, author of the authoritative book, Homicide Investigation, and medico-legal director of the Michigan State Police. Dr. Snyder will speak from Detroit. Dr. Snyder.
As a police scientist, I appreciate this opportunity to speak on a nationwide broadcast. It is my hope that the dramatization we have just heard emphasizes the futility of criminal schemes in the face of scientific crime detection. This is a relatively new science. But last year, the police of this country arrested over 540,000 persons who thought they could cheat the law. That was last year. In coming years, practical scientists exploring the unknown will add new weapons to the scientific armament of crime detection. New scientific weapons like television in color, flashing the photograph of a fleeing criminal or suspect onto the radio in your own home, enabling you to cooperate with the police. Infrared rays to aim police carbines in the dark of night. Best pocket wire recorders to convict criminals by the evidence of their own voices. From the laboratories of science come ever new weapons to aid crime detection, to make safer your world of tomorrow.
Thank you, Dr. Snyder. You have been listening to your Science Magazine of the Air. Today's program, The Story of Scientific Crime Detection, was one of the series Exploring the Unknown.